This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Pop-up AstraZeneca vaccine clinics where no appointments are needed are a key part of the strategy to tackle Sydney's COVID outbreak, especially in the city's west and southwest, in suburbs with the city's highest case numbers and areas with some of the lowest vaccination rates. The Berejiklian government set 6 million doses in the state by the end of the month as a target before the lockdown may be eased. David Sparks reports from southwest Sydney.
It's a sunny winter's day on the sports fields of Parry Park in Lakemba. And at one end is a pop-up AstraZeneca vaccine clinic. No appointment needed.
Why am I getting the AstraZeneca vaccine? A lot of reasons. First of all, for prevention. We're all a community, so we're kind of in this together. We're not alone.
Nurses from the pop-up clinic have also been walking around the park, inviting people over for a dose of AstraZeneca. One man who's been coming to the park every day to exercise since he lost his job was approached by the nurses on Monday. He needed a couple of days to think about it.
And I chatted to my doctor and they're like, listen, it's totally up to you. I mean, go get it if you feel like you want to. And I said, might as well, you know, while I'm here and the pop-up's only here for about 4 days anyway. And I just thought about it and I'm like, pull the trigger.
Hi there, you've just had your AstraZeneca shot. How did it go?
Excellent. Wonderful. Initially, I had wanted the Pfizer. So I was waiting on the Pfizer, but then this happened, this outbreak. So I go, well, I better get something, which is better than nothing.
One thing many pop-up clinics have going for them is their place in the community. At the Lau Cultural Centre in Edenza Park near Fairfield, a pop-up clinic was launched next to a Buddhist temple yesterday.
We are overwhelmed with the response. We have over 200 people come in for vaccination.
Buntan Wonsaya is president of Lau Community Advancement New South Wales. He says the pop-up clinic will operate every Wednesday.
We have some Cambodian and there are some Thai people. I would say probably 95% is Lau. The rest is other community.
Right. And was language much of a factor on day one? Was there much translating to be done?
Mainly Lau in Thai. So we have to help them with the understanding of the risk and the medical condition. See, the response today is confirmed what we believe. The people in our community are just like were hesitant to go somewhere else because of language barrier, because they're not confident. When they come here, they see their friends coming, they bring their friend, they ask each other for help, for support, and they come to us, they feel more at ease.
Local chemists are also part of the AstraZeneca drive. Belmore pharmacist William Demian says word is getting around.
Generally, it's been quite busy. So we have received a good response from the local area where we've been doing almost, you know, 60, 70 vaccines each day, which is pretty good. You know, it's a good response from our local community.
What about the types of people? I mean, what types of age groups are you getting?
No, it's generally from young to old, I guess. People with the Medicare, people without a Medicare. It's really anyone who's walking past the shop or who's heard that we are giving the vaccine, they're coming and getting it done. Initially, they had only set the criteria for 40 years and older, but now, since it's been 18 years and older, we've had young guys who are 18 and, you know, they're eager to get the vaccine done. So they've been coming in, people who just want to get back to work, you know, middle age. And so definitely word of mouth is spreading pretty quickly.
Belmore pharmacist William Demian, ending that report by David Sparks. As COVID lockdowns continue in Sydney and southeast Queensland, governments say the vaccination rates of workers and residents in aged care has prevented COVID deaths in these latest outbreaks. But while it's mandatory for residential aged care workers to have at least one dose by mid-September, there's no similar deadline for home care workers. And new figures from the Health Department reveal just 16% of home care workers are fully vaccinated. Social Affairs correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
My question is addressed to the Prime Minister.
In Parliament yesterday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison boasted about the vaccination rate for residential aged care workers.
We continue to make strong progress in relation to the vaccination of aged care workers. Over 50% of those, Mr. Speaker, now vaccinated.
But when it comes to home care workers who help older Australians in their own homes, the vaccination rate is far lower. The Department of Health says responses from 70% of home care package providers reveals 34% of workers have one dose of vaccine and just 16% are fully vaccinated. Pat Sparrow is the CEO of Peakbody Aged and Community Services Australia, which represents providers.
We're reporting on vaccination of staff, but of course it's not mandatory for home care staff to be vaccinated. We think that it should be. Home care workers who go into the homes of over a million Australians, we need to make sure that they're vaccinated too.
Providers such as Kalara Communities Aged Care in Adelaide say the problem is much more about the availability of vaccines for their home care workforce than it is about hesitancy. And, says Kalara CEO Sarah Blunt, the lack of vaccinated workers is a challenge.
We do have clients who are starting to express their personal concern and say, we want home care workers who have had a vaccination. That's our preference. And that is starting to be something we've got a few concerns about.
For home care workers like Teresa Hetherington in Newcastle, the frustration is boiling over. She's under 50, and due to a medical condition, her doctor has recommended the Pfizer vaccine. She can't get it.
So I've literally been trying to get vaccinated for months. I only got onto the waiting list in the last month. And of course, last week, a lot of the vaccination appointments in Newcastle and the Hunter Valley were reallocated to Sydney.
What's it like for you and your co-workers to be struggling to get vaccine when you know that you're going in and helping older Australians who could be vulnerable?
Well, not being able to get COVID vaccination and not being 100% sure from day to day whether we have it or whether we could pass it on to the clients or even if our clients may have it has put incredible strain on the entire workforce. I'm absolutely stunned at this point that we haven't actually had a major outbreak in the community because of this reason.
Home care worker Teresa Hetherington ending Norman Hermont's report. It's been revealed thousands of Australian churches and other religious groups pocketed millions of dollars in JobKeeper last year. An ABC investigation into the financial records of more than 100 of the religious organisations has discovered many qualified for the wage subsidy despite seeing little financial impact from last year's COVID-19 economic shock. Now, there are calls for them to pay back the money. This report by Pat McGrath from ABC Investigations.
St Paul's Cathedral in Bendigo has witnessed more than one pandemic since it was built almost 150 years ago. But last year's COVID-19 lockdowns were a challenge for Anglican Bishop Matt Brain.
It went from four services with about 250 or 300 people every Sunday to once a week, the Dean of the Cathedral and I would film a service.
The switch to online services meant a big drop in collection plate donations across the region's 32 Anglican congregations.
We were facing the real prospect of me having to go to those wonderful clergy and saying, look, I'm sorry, we just don't have the money to be able to pay you.
The diocese collected $1 million in JobKeeper last year, just one of 3,500 religious institutions that received a total of $627 million from the federal government. An ABC investigation has examined the financial records of more than 100 of those organisations and found that dozens posted surpluses while receiving the wage subsidy. Labor MP Andrew Lee thinks any organisation that saw a windfall should consider paying the money back.
But I also think that the Morrison government needs to be held to account for running a scheme which continued to hand out money to firms with rising earnings.
In a statement, the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg welcomed organisations paying back JobKeeper if they could. He says JobKeeper has helped religious and other charities continue their vitally important work during the pandemic. Religious practitioners like priests, nuns and rabbis weren't originally included in JobKeeper because they're not technically employees. Monash University law professor Luke Beck, whose work examines the legality of government funding of religion, questions whether the decision to extend JobKeeper to religious practitioners in May last year fit with the scheme's intention.
This was to keep workers connected to their employers so that when things got better, people would still have their jobs to go back to. Now, I'm not sure there was really very much risk that churches would go around sacking their priests or their pastors or mosques would go around sacking their imams.
Bishop Matt Brain disagrees. He says without JobKeeper, religious practitioners may have been forced to abandon their work.
I would have had to put them in the Hobson's choice of doing a job that they thought was morally right without any capacity to keep bread on the table.
That's Anglican Bishop Matt Brain, ending that report by Pat McGrath. A year ago, a devastating explosion ripped through the port of Beirut, killing hundreds of people, including two-year-old Australian Isaac Ollers, and leaving parts of the city in ruins. An investigation by Lebanese authorities has been hampered by political interference and has yet to bring a single senior official to account. Middle East correspondent Tom Joyner filed this report from Beirut.
George Hayek remembers driving home past the port of Beirut when his world turned upside down.
The ground went out. The car flew for like 2 meters high. You see, it's totally black, like you are in hell.
Only a few hundred meters away, thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate had suddenly exploded, sending shockwaves through the Lebanese capital, eventually killing at least 200 and injuring thousands of others.
I'm here now after all this, but the emotion is very, very high. How I managed to survive, my life is miraculous.
On the first anniversary of the Beirut blast, George Hayek, like tens of thousands of others, is marching to send a message to the country's leaders.
I blame the political people who was running the country. They robbed everything and made us poor.
At the time of the blast, many in Lebanon had hoped the country's leaders would be brought to account for their corruption and mismanagement. But so far, there's been little change. And with Lebanon in the midst of an unfolding economic crisis, many feel like things have become worse.
Anger, it's everywhere. The problem, how to convert this anger to a social force.
Nizar Sagia is the head of Legal Agenda, a Lebanese non-profit that's been advocating on behalf of blast victims. He says despite everything, things are gradually shifting.
So you have a new political life emerging in Lebanon. This case becomes somehow the symbol of justice for Lebanese people against the regime.
It's a fight for justice that Abdo Faraon is willing to see through to the end.
I am very, very angry. We want to know who's behind this crime. We are the victims and we won't accept this.
The 77-year-old's home overlooking the port was blown to pieces. Inside its shattered walls is now a jungle of scaffolding and debris. Any furniture that survived the explosion was quickly looted.
I was born in this house. I grew up here and I got married here. What makes me sad is to think that I won't pass this house down to my grandchildren. All the dreams we had, it's all gone.
But for other survivors of the blast, like George Hayek, there's still hope.
Now we are surviving this. Hopefully this day will be a new beginning for new Lebanon.
This is Tom Joyner in Beirut, reporting for AM.
In the United States, a woman's right to have an abortion is facing its greatest threat since it was granted almost 50 years ago in the landmark case known as Roe v. Wade. The new conservative majority on the Supreme Court, installed under Donald Trump, is poised to hear its first case challenging that ruling. North America correspondent Catherine Diss has gained rare access to abortion clinics in the Midwest and filed this report.
Don't kill your baby. They'll kill your black baby. We love them. Please run.
In America's Bible Belt, abortion clinics are under attack.
They will rip your child apart.
God's threats are not a mere empty threat.
And so too are the rights women won almost 50 years ago.
Good morning, good morning.
Dr. Colleen McNicholas has been on the front line of the pro-abortion movement in America's Midwest for 12 years.
This is the last remaining abortion clinic in the state of Missouri, serving more than a million reproductive age women.
She's taking me behind the picket line to her surgery in the conservative state of Missouri.
To sit back and think about the fairly rapid deterioration of access in Missouri. You know, 30 clinics perhaps when I was born, 11 a decade ago, and now just one. And every day seems like a fight to keep this clinic open.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions.
In 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court handed women in all 50 states the right to choose abortion in the first two trimesters of pregnancy. The controversial ruling has divided Americans for decades. In the coming year, the Supreme Court will hear a case from Mississippi, which wants to ban abortion after 15 weeks, except in extreme circumstances. It's a direct challenge to the Roe v. Wade precedent. Already, other states like Missouri have introduced restrictions, meaning where a woman lives in the US dictates her access to the procedure.
You're going to hit your head. You better stop.
In one of the state's poorest neighbourhoods, Ferguson, I meet 31-year-old single mother of three, India Kent. She's decided to end an unwanted pregnancy.
It is the more loving choice for me. It will set me back. At least I will most definitely be a single parent. Financially, we'll make it, but it will be a struggle.
But to have that choice, she's crossing the border into the state of Illinois, where abortions are cheaper and take just a few hours.
This is my body. I just feel no one should be able to tell you what you can and cannot do with your own self.
Surrounded by conservative states, Illinois has become an oasis for abortion rights for women in the South and Midwest. While Dr. McNicholas still performs abortions in Missouri, she now treats most of her patients in Illinois.
This is exactly what a post-Roe world looks like. It looks like people being abandoned by their state and them needing to figure out ways to get to other states to give that, to get the care that they need and deserve.
If Roe versus Wade is overturned, almost half of the states in the US are poised to effectively ban abortion.
Catherine Diss reporting, and you can watch Catherine's story on Foreign Correspondent on ABC TV tonight or on iView. A remote Arnhem community and its Sydney partners are celebrating the success of the first stage of an ambitious plan to establish a spring water bottling project. They've sent the first supplies of water from the spring on the edge of their community to the nearest town 170 kilometres away. As Jane Barden reports, they're hoping the business will provide local jobs and money for a permanent teacher.
For the tiny Manjawoi community, Anyolnu clan leaders from across East Arnhem Land sending the first truckload of their spring water out to be packaged in cardboard cartons was an exciting milestone. They plan to use the profits to build a packaging plant here. Community leader Rur Willing Urton says they also want to fund a full-time teaching position.
We want our kids to go to school here and to become an educator so they can work here in our business.
Their partner Rod Baker says they've already got some customers, including a ferry company.
We're using a contract packer to package our water, and then presuming that we prove that there's enough demand, which we're very confident will happen, then we'll establish the factory here.
It's a very challenging business model trying to start something like this in a very, very remote area of the NT. How are you really planning to make this succeed?
You know, economic sustainability is just numbers, really, isn't it? The money coming in has got to be more than the money going out.
Yolnu leader and local MP Yinye Markgula says the water is viewed as culturally precious and knowledge-giving.
This place is a place for knowledge ceremonies. It's like a parliament house. The knowledge systems comes from the springs, and that's how it's called, the knowledge water.
The partners have gained $750,000 in seed funding from the federally managed ABA Aboriginal Mining Royalties Fund. Brewa Munungura is the chair of the Yolnu People's MeWatch Employment Organisation, which has also provided $200,000.
This has set a prime example for all homelands to develop a very good business, you know, and it's our money, Aboriginal money, given to an Aboriginal body that really wants to start up their business.
As the first truck drove out, community leader Mapu Urathan found it bittersweet letting the water go.
Feel sad wanting to stay our water back at home.
I feel sad sharing it, but I suppose joyful too, I guess.
Yes, we feel joyful and excited.
Community leader Mapu Urathan speaking there with Jane Barden. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
The US Supreme Court has agreed to hear an appeal that could validate an effective ban on abortion in Mississippi after 15 weeks. It's a case that will have far-reaching consequences for the entire country.
Today on The Signal, in the months since Donald Trump's defeat, America's abortion debate has only been intensifying, and the focus is now turning to the conservative majority on the US Supreme Court. So could the US be on the path to banning abortion? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.